as they explore the opportunity to create what we're calling an internet enterprise zone in Iceland, or a charter node on the internet akin to charter cities. But the idea is that there's an opportunity there to develop a policy framework that supports investment in internet infrastructure and also serves the interests of innovation and progress on the web globally. So just very, very briefly, we just wanted to do introductions around the room, name, affiliation, and that's it, because there's a lot of people, just so everybody knows who everybody is. And then Ari Johnson, who's the president of the Reykjavik University, is going to say a few words about the Icelandic context and framing the opportunity there. It's worth noting that they have just created something called the Internet Policy Institute of Iceland that's going to be housed at the Reykjavik University, which is in many ways similar to the Berkman Center. So they're very excited to meet all of you and to learn how that works here and how they can collaborate. And with that, I will let people say hello.
Yochai Benkler, faculty at the Berkman Center and Harvard Law School.
Nive Elkin-Koren from the Haifa Center for Law and Technology in Israel.
George Papandreou, IOP Fellow, former Prime Minister of Greece.
John Penny, Fellow at the Berkman Center.
Tryggvi Herbertsson, Parliamentarian from Iceland.
Adam Berkowitz from the Internet Bar Organization.
Ruha Devanesan, Fellow at the Berkman Center.
Maria Löblich, Fellow at the Berkman Center.
Molly Sauter, Fellow at the Berkman Center.
I'm Ari Högson, Managing Director of the Federation of Icelandic Industries and Chairman of a VC Fund in Iceland.
I am Gudjon Gudjonsson, a facilitator at the Internet Policy Institute in Iceland.
Kit Walsh, Fellow at the Berkman Center.
Oliver Goodenough, Faculty Fellow at Berkman Center and Professor at Vermont Law School.
Finn Rodson, Managing Director of the Iceland Chamber of Commerce.
Brad Burnham, Union Square Ventures.
I'm Jerome, an economist and a fellow at Berkman Center.
I'm Borja Echevarria, I'm Nieman and Berkman Fellow and Deputy Editor at El País in Spain.
David O'Brien, a Project Manager at the Berkman Center.
Jason Schultz, a Clinical Professor from UC Berkeley, visiting at NYU Law School.
Diana Kimball, student at Harvard Business School and Berkman Fellow.
Mayo Fuster-Morey, Berkman Fellow from Barcelona.
Ryan Budish, Berkman Fellow.
Jeff Hermes at the Digital Media Law Project at the Berkman Center.
Rob Farrison, the Research Director at the Berkman Center.
Eger Odewale, I'm a fellow at the Berkman Center.
Andy Sellers, Digital Media Law Project and Berkman Fellow.
I'm Derek Slater, and I'm on Google's public policy team.
Urs Gasser, I'm the Executive Director of the Berkman Center, and warm welcome to everyone on behalf of Team Berkman.
Colin McClay, Berkman Center.
Sasha Meinrath, I direct the Numerica Foundation's Open Technology Institute.
My name is Ari Johnson, I'm at Reykjavik University.
Margot Kaminsky, Yale Law School.
I'm David Sneed, I'm a lawyer and I'm with the Internet Infrastructure Coalition.
Eskua Hosiner, fellow at the Mustafa Rahmani Center for Business and Government, another former prime minister here coming from Finland.
Joshua Gans, University of Toronto.
And Heather Whitney, Berkman Fellow.
So as you'll hear in a second, I think there's a really interesting opportunity in Iceland, given their economic and physical context and history and current political environment. We're really excited to be here with all of you to tap into some of the experience and ideas that you all have in your heads. So with that, Ari Johnson from the University of Reykjavik.
You want me to come up there?
So thank you all, and it's a great pleasure to be here. Very happy about that. So Nick asked me on the way to say some words to frame how we see this from the Icelandic point of view, And I will count on my Icelandic fellows to jump in and add as needed. So I jotted down some notes here to go through. Now, Iceland is, as you may know, it's an island nation in the middle of the Northern Atlantic. It is straddling the plates between North America and Europe, and it's touching the Arctic Circle. Now, despite the fact that we're that far north, it's actually a nice temperate area. And one of the advantages that Iceland has when we look at this kind of industry is that it's a very temperate climate, ranging really from about 30 degrees Fahrenheit in the winter up to about 65 degrees in the summer. So it's a comfortable place to be, both for people and for computers. Now, it is in a way in the middle of nowhere, but in a way it's also very central. It's well connected to both the Northern America side as well as to Europe. It takes 2 hours to get to London. It's actually a shorter trip from Boston to Reykjavik than it is from Boston to San Francisco. So it gives you a bit of a perspective of how close Iceland really is. Now, probably the things that Iceland is most famous for is for causing some of the largest bankruptcies in the history through the bank collapse that happened in October 2008. This resulted from a rapidly growing financial industry in Iceland that then collapsed due to the liquidity crisis in 2008. And that resulted in an economic recession for Iceland, a currency crisis, and a number of other issues that we are recovering from now today. Now, the other thing that Iceland is famous for, of course, is our volcanoes. So if any of you were stuck somewhere in an airplane, our apologies. But as one of my fellow delegates pointed out, we crashed the banking system in 2008. We halted air traffic in 2012. So one of the things that we're looking at now is, what are we going to do in 2012 that turns all of the ice of the world to Iceland again? Now, we have a highly developed democratic society with a good technical infrastructure. We have green energy. Virtually all of our electricity is produced by renewable, clean, green energy. We have a nice climate for operating computers and so on and so forth. We have fairly good connectivity to the world, although it could be improved if we continue to build up this kind of an industry. Icelanders are very driven, very innovative, and one of the things that you learn as a nation when you've, well, collapsed a banking system or gotten struck by a volcano is how to dig yourself out. So everybody pulls together and is willing to work really hard to make things happen. Another thing that I want to point out about Iceland and why this is an interesting opportunity is that we are not encumbered by a long history of many of the laws that are getting in the way of other things, especially here in the United States. So there's not this long ream of copyright laws, patent things, et cetera, that sometimes get in the way. Now, we are going through a period right now where we have dealt with the worst effects of the economic recession and the crash, and we're now looking at how we're going to build up Iceland and what are the opportunities for the future. And this is something that is across the political spectrum, and there's a unique opportunity now in Iceland to have an impact on how we're actually going to set things up so as to build up economic activity and to find where we're going to lead in the world and how we're going to attract investment and attention. So what we're looking at is, in this context, is what can we do to set up a framework, a legal framework, an infrastructure framework, and the entrepreneurial framework in Iceland so that we attract innovation in the internet, in digital media, in content, based on a sensible, clear, predictable legal environment that is user-centered and will draw innovation, will draw investment, and will draw people to Iceland. That's from our point of view. From the point of view of what we're doing for the world, then, is to create a place where we can be sure that the internet innovation can continue to thrive, and that is some of the things that we're going to talk about here today. So in a way, Iceland is a very unique place, and if you want to visit, by all means do it. It's well worth it. There are some constraints on what we're looking at. I mean, we're not looking for a pirate haven or things like that. But what we're looking at is a sensible place with sensible laws where you can actually foster innovation. And in the infrastructure that we have, with the unique environment that we have politically, and us looking towards the future, and being in this unique location, this is a unique opportunity to really impacting how we see the internet develop and innovation develop over the next years and even decades. So really looking forward to getting all of your inputs, and please think how we should tackle this, what are the issues to address, and I look forward to the discussion here. Thank you.
Terrific. Thank you, Ari. Thank you very much. Well, everybody, hi. Thank you, Ari. That was great. I'm Susan Crawford. I'm a visiting professor here and also a part of the Berkman family. And one of the thought experiments we use when thinking about the future is to imagine a frictionless future. Imagine a digital living room with no obstacles. Here, we're being asked to imagine a country with a thousandth the population of the United States that's able to move forward quickly in this time of vulnerability to rethink its place in the world. So I put all of you in the position of advisor to the head of state, and you are meeting with that advisor tomorrow morning. And it's your first task to think about the three categories that Ari has given us: infrastructure, legal structure, and encouragement to entrepreneurship. And come up with your top priorities for areas where the focus should be for that leader of government. Okay, so let's go. We're going to go fast here. Come on, come up with three. No fear. Raise your hands. I'm going to call on you because you're all really smart. Okay, Jason, tell me. What's your top priority?
So I have the advantage of we were chatting a little earlier.
Yeah.
I think that an emphasis on users being able to own digital content and then make decisions about it that are not subject to copyright under control, much like the first sale doctrine operates in analog spaces, to make a very clear space for that in the digital realm. Since so much of the development and entrepreneurship on the internet has allowed for users to create new pathways for sharing information, for using their own information, I think that would be a huge step forward.
Okay, so sharing and use of information. Let's build on that. A couple more ideas here before we go on to something else. Sharing and using information. This is a big one. Brad.
Iceland's in the middle of the North Atlantic. Its spectrum policy does not have to conform to everybody else's spectrum policy because it's really hard to imagine interfering with anybody else. And so use it as an opportunity to create something new.
Okay. Infrastructure as a focus. Spectrum policy is one place where we could spend a lot of time. Spectrum and fiber infrastructure as well, right? Make sure that Iceland has the leading low latency, high speed connection of any country in the world. Imagine again, you have to really put yourself into this digital space with no limitations, no limitations on storage, computation, or connectivity. And now, what do we need for legal infrastructure? We got spectrum policy on the table for physical infrastructure. We talked about sharing content. What else on the legal side? Imagine a perfect land. What is it, Oliver?
Well, one of the things might be to imagine a new space for institutional structures of organizing collaborative interaction. Whether it's in a sort of just the simple steps of digitizing more traditional style corporate and business entities, but also imagining what the new collaboration looks like and how you create a reliable collaborative platform with legal backing into which that can be plugged.
Okay, so two important ideas. One is allowing a very easy corporate form to touch down in Iceland, which could be formed on the fly, and also institutional collaborations that make working together easy. Yes?
I think small is beautiful in certain areas of internet-based businesses, services and businesses, especially when I'm looking at those areas which are under the control of governments, like education, healthcare. We have a lot of potential which is still unused because of lack of systemic capabilities. And small nation like Iceland can be big in creating those because there are less obstacles, less burdens for that kind of innovation. And to be honest, I've been working for Nokia, and I haven't seen any country in the world which has been good in that.
So your top piece of advice for the minister tomorrow morning is what?
look at the country as a platform, uh-huh. and how to integrate public and private in a way which creates the best environment for innovation, in especially in the sectors which are closely linked to governmental services.
Okay, and so steps towards that. Yes, I see you have a mic, so tell me, Jeff.
Sure. On the legal side, I'm thinking protection for intermediaries against the consequences of user conduct, but okay. at the same time, protection for users against intermediary censorship.
All right. So we get lots of, the country's a platform, that's our first step, and now we've got lots of intermediaries who are platforms. Everybody's facilitating a lot of innovation. Why would anybody invest in such a world if they can't erect some barriers to entry that let them capture rents? Why are they going to invest?
I'm a journalist. From the point of view of media, I would advise from the beginning of creating all this to create a space on the web where you communicate in a transparent way everything mm-hmm. you're doing from the mm-hmm. beginning. Even if it's not perfect, but try to reach everybody inside and outside the country what you are doing, small things, big things, and try to build a unique space where you can access to everything that okay. is being done.
These three ideas go together. So Oliver's saying make it easy to work together, and Borja is saying show what you're doing, and I've forgotten your name, is saying make it possible for the entire country to do these things, to show what it's doing and to make collaboration easy. Let's stick on this sort of frame. What institutional setups? We let platforms be free from liability. What else? Yeah.
This would be a great opportunity to put in some either at the corporate level or at the national level in terms of national policy, information security guidelines and security best practices that privilege users' rights and interoperability primarily.
Okay. So this is like spectrum policy, sort of a necessary input, is that users are going to own their own stuff, so that's from Jeff, and Molly says, and they're going to be able to rely on its security, but in the way that they want. Say a few more words about that. How do you preference users with security?
Primarily something like, without getting too technical, which I don't have time to do right now, something like data breach disclosure guidelines uh-huh. that apply nationally and have strict disclosure dates, types of disclosure, what types of breaches must be disclosed, that have a preference for keeping the users informed rather than protecting the reputation of the company that's been breached.
Okay, so we hear in the room a lot of emphasis on users and their content. Users, are secure, but not in the name of protecting the brand, although we want to protect intermediaries and keep them from being liable. So we love intermediaries. Okay, let's move up. Yes.
So building on Borja's idea and any of the other ideas here, I would stress the relevance of having a good open public data policy so that people can reuse the data that's generated through public funds while avoiding two caveats. The first one, actually one very strong caveat, which is governments are really usually open to the idea of having open data. But when it comes to releasing it in a good form, they want to control the output, what people do with this data, which is actually a bad idea because the very essence of it is to let the people take this data, and you can't imagine what they're going to do with it, and this will foster innovation. The second thing is to have a public data policy, second caveat, that's actually released in a format that's easily usable. And many times, governments release a lot of data. They say, it's all there. But you cannot transform it. You cannot take it. You cannot reuse it. So, that would be my two cents.
Okay, so a standardization effort and a big push towards public data in a usable form. How do you encourage intermediaries to arrive who are going to help us work with that data? Yoka.
So I apologize that I have to leave to teach in 5 minutes.
Yes, but you just have more good ideas than all of us. So, go right ahead.
So if the problem, I was thinking in terms of Delaware in the U.S. and how Delaware was able to become the place where companies want to incorporate. By solving for a particular problem, which is the tension between the directors and executives and the shareholders and creating a right people want the right things, get the defaults that they want. And I'm wondering what that is unique about Iceland. And I think if the focus is on two things. One is the costs of starting a business that are associated with tax from major existing sources of power, which is to say incumbents, particularly incumbents in the content industry, and national security agencies. Two things that are and compliance requirements by national security type frameworks. So one, to design a system that provide real data haven capabilities, and that's not trivial because a lot of countries, you'd need to do all sorts of things in terms of the domicile, in terms of making sure that when it, the data is posted there, it's really the company, it's really independent, there's a way to really be there, not be under the jurisdiction of the major other potential attacking jurisdictions like the US, like the EU. But the flip side, to make it not just sort of a pirate haven, which is not a bad thing, not just that, is also to create certain constraints on the power of the corporations against their users. So if today we have very open and free, company can design whatever terms of service it uses, think about designing ways of binding companies that start out and anchor in Iceland to the mast of really putting the users' interests first and not being able, whether that means that users have a role in determining the terms of service, some form of participation and voice within the running of the services, but in a way that's actually bound to getting all of the advantages of the jurisdictional cover. So that is generally moving yourself from major incumbents in existing industries and governments as your sources of constraint to your users as your sources of constraint, in both cases using the Icelandic law.
Fantastic. So big moves here, lowering the cost of doing business at all levels. All the inputs become cheaper. And then having a flag, like a ship travels under a flag. And all the companies that touch down in Iceland, this is Oliver's big idea for Vermont, are bound to adhere to certain norms of action, participation, and also protect users, and also are shielded from incumbents in a way that allows them to be more creative. Okay, this sounds good, but let's keep going. There's always more we can do. Yes, Mika.
So I'll build on what Yochai has said and also try to channel Eric Von Hippel a little bit. My responsibility as a student. I wanted to suggest that thinking about innovation policy in terms of user-centered innovation processes, because very often when people think about it, and they write laws to support innovation, they support innovation by firms, but not just firms, but by manufacturers who are expecting to innovate in the process of selling their innovations, and that policies that support user-centered innovation might look very different, and then thinking about user entrepreneurship, people who are creating solutions to their own problems, and then in the process building out their own internet infrastructure, and then finding ways to help them commercialize those innovations and sort of bring them back into the market, is I think a very cool direction that would be very compatible with a lot of the other types of suggestions that people have made.
Okay, so let's make sure that we're encouraging user-centered design. I want to go back to Yochai's idea of the flag, the thing you bind yourself to. Let's list some more policies that would be part of joining the club in Iceland. Right? We've got the idea of allowing your users to work on your terms of service, user-centered security, users own their own stuff. What other kinds of policies should be part of the Icelandic flag? Yes.
Promote policies for gender inclusion.
Gender inclusion? Yeah,
yes,
that's right.
Because the collaborative production, like in the case of Wikipedia or free software, show to increase gender inequality in society, so to promote.
You mean in Iceland?
Because
in Nordic countries, I think that gender inclusion already exists. I think that we have more challenges with the males than females.
Well, I think this is a very serious issue, and gender is something that needs to be considered from the start. And a key element, I think, is the starting point, not to consider it like something to solve afterward.
Okay. So corporate policies, we've touched on some. Anything else that we want to add to the Icelandic flag as a condition of touching down in Iceland? You agree. What one?
Yeah, perhaps relating to, at the very least, some baseline of transparency with regards to censorship or responding to other countries' concerns about what a corporation may or may not be doing. So at the very least, that there's a centralized place where you can see how these countries or companies are responding to those, and perhaps even better would be, you know, some kind of commitment to maintaining an open and free, service.
Okay, so we've got this long list of things to which you agree to bind yourself. What's the quid pro quo? What does government do to make it attractive for a company to touch down in Iceland? Now that they've agreed to be such wonderful corporate citizens, why would they go there? What are they getting for it? Why are they investing? It's a hard question, right? We want all these good activities from corporations. They're there because there's an educated workforce. Why else are all of them?
You're having to make a balance between what stage in the corporate lifespan you are. I mean, as Sokai's pointed out, the incumbent corporations are not necessarily interested in the next round of innovation if it disrupts their current plan.
Right.
And what you're, I think, asking is, do we incentivize startups, or do we invite AT&T to locate their next data center with us? And your strategies may be a little different depending upon which of those targets you're aiming at.
Okay, well, I see some hands going up. Yes, Sasha.
So to concretize maybe, three things perhaps that Iceland can offer. One would be much lower transaction costs. If you disintermediate sort of the ASCAPs and RIAs and MPAAs and law enforcement and the telcos and the incumbents and all that, the cost of doing business will go down dramatically. Number two is I think you have less risk. If you have laws that say, look, the locus of control is with the users, you've already agreed to do that by providing this technology or doing this intervention there, then all of a sudden you have less legal liability possible within that kind of environment. And the third, which I don't know if it's up there explicitly, but if you're using standards-based open technologies, non-proprietary things, unencumbered solutions, then you have this possibility of much more enhanced or faster iterative design innovation within that kind of environment. If you give the tools for people to innovate and free them up to do so, that is a huge value add.
Fantastic. So what we've been doing is building the groundwork, the sidewalk, that's going to make it possible for a lot of innovation to occur. Now we have to consider how you protect Iceland from being viewed as a haven for piracy, where the balance is. So Brett is looking for a mic. There we go.
So one of the conversations that came up this morning is the possibility that if you had a sort of user-centric, instead of incumbent-centric copyright framework, it might include a requirement to register a copyright and re-register a copyright annually to keep it alive. That would open up the possibility that Iceland could become a repository of the world's knowledge because it would get access to orphan works and things like that. But if you did that, obviously that's an imposition on the incumbent intellectual property rights holders. And what would you give them in exchange? Perhaps what you could give them is an automated system for clearing those rights that would disintermediate ASCAP, which is expensive, but it could be a completely digital, completely automated system that would allow for a self-service clearance of the rights, which may open up the market to a much larger group of people using those copyrighted materials.
Boy, so imagine that we reinstantiate formalities for copyright so that you can have a meaningful repository and allow for the clearing of rights and be the place, the sort of internet archive of copyrighted material, have its locus be in Iceland, and maybe pay a very small levy on the use of that registry that goes right back into the Icelandic coffers. So it's a business model as well. What do you think there?
Wait, let me just add to that too. I think the perception of jurisdictions and whether they're respectful or not of intellectual property gets distorted along certain lines. I think you want to have enforcement, but the question is the enforcement reasonable? Does it have due process? And what are the kind of remedies and penalties, right? So one of the issues, for instance, in the U.S. is the statutory damages for copyright which can be up to $150,000 per work, right? I think you could actually not have any statutory damages at all, have actual damages. You still enforce copyrights. If someone has caused harm and you can prove it, you get, you know, compensation as a copyright owner. I think it's hard to call that a haven for piracy. I really do. I think that that sounds reasonable to me. You might have certain, willfulness enhancements, things like that, but I think that tying things to actual harm is actually a really reasonable, sensible way to go about things. That would then take away a lot of the leverage that I think people feel like copyright owners can use to exploit people in situations where they're kind of at the end of the barrel. The other thing I'd say is that for the companies, and again, this is maybe one of the things that would attract them, the secondary liability rules, if they either try and qualify for a safe harbor, right, where they're not liable at all, but even if they don't qualify for that, the uncertainty that they face based on user conduct is a real problem in the U.S., and I think trying to provide some cap or limitation on their liability as well could also still allow enforcement, but not have it be such a threat that, yeah, people may not want to invest at all, it's a risky business enterprise, versus, oh, I see what the risk is, and I can actually calculate for it.
Okay, let's anticipate additional risks. We're focusing a good deal right now on copyright because that's where a lot of us live, but there's other content online that may find a welcome home in Iceland. We've posited a world without censorship. How does Iceland protect itself, again, from being seen as a sort of dump of material? So help us out.
This is not a direct answer to that, so okay. I apologize. But I just wanted to say one thing to think about is that you might not care. I mean, if you think about your situation in terms of what you're importing versus what you're exporting, you can articulate your decision to grant protection to things based on what you actually want to be exporting, rather than be in a place where strong rights that are created in other countries allow people who live in other countries to enforce them against people who live in Iceland.
Mm-hmm. Yes, Sasha.
So I would love to turn this entire thing on its head and make it sort of a bastion for fair use.
Near your mouth.
Hello?
Yes.
Okay. Make it a bastion for fair use. And I don't know if this is possible, but I'd love to see sort of a just some nation do just a strict reciprocity on copyright. So it's like, oh, you want to charge $150,000 if I've infringed on your copyright? That's cool. But if you put a DMCA or something like that on my fair use and you're wrong, then you owe me $150,000, right? And so you sort of sidestep the whole, like, trying to figure out some sane way to go after copyright by actively protecting fair use, and you just make it the exact same infringement cost one way or the other.
Okay, so sensible copyright law. What about other regimes? A patent. There must be some patent experts here. Yes.
I'm not a patent expert, but I do know that software developers hate software patents.
There you go.
I think that just any gesture you can make toward sort of crushing that, maybe not on the international scene, but perhaps adopting something like Twitter's innovator patent agreement as the baseline expected agreement for companies in Iceland, and also just doing whatever else you can to show that you're... One way to prevent the perception of Iceland as a haven for piracy is just to increase the number of other things that are coming out of it, and the welcomeness that the independent software developers feel while there, which could lead to companies in the future.
Okay. Yes, Maker? It's coming towards you.
I think that to go back to my earlier point about user innovation, one way in which you could support that is by making it very clear that firms or manufacturers or producers are not going to be responsible for modifications of their products or for use, and that they don't need to, because one of the arguments that firms will make is that they don't want to allow their product to be used in all kinds of different ways because they might be liable for ways in which it's misused or in which it becomes dangerous or so on and so forth. So making it very clear that that type of liability doesn't exist, I think, would be a very positive step.
Okay, other information policies. What about surveillance? Interesting notion. Does this play into our vision of what the frictionless internet should be like? What should the government be doing? Come on, guys. Be imaginative. That's why we're here. Surveillance. So no more surveillance. Nobody's watched. Any thoughts about this? Yes, Andy.
So, akin to American wiretapping law, very strong procedural safeguards that must be imposed before you can begin surveillance. and transparency in decisions made in surveillance, even if you can't disclose the subject, annual reports on how many, you know, if there is a national security type wiretap, disclosure of how many of those are applied for, how many of those are imposed, and as soon as possible, right. Consistent with law enforcement, making these available for scrutiny and review.
And sort of the assurance that there is reasonable monitoring. This is all sensible, right? So just as there is reasonable enforcement of copyright law, reasonable monitoring of, you know, with some level of proof.
With meaningful
criminal activity.
Yeah.
And with the involvement of a judicial officer, not...
Yes, and a neutral officer of some form.
Okay, so we fixed that one. Isn't this great? We can just whiz through all these subjects. What other body of law have you been wanting to...
Oh, no, I have another surveillance one.
Oh, come on, make it.
I mean, just like support for... legal support for something like the Do Not Track initiative. So allowing users to opt out from tracking across multiple websites in ways that they don't want. Or even support for an opt-in system. I mean, that would be...
Okay. But. Have we done enough to think of positive, outpourings from Iceland that protect it from the image of being a pirate? Have we done enough on that score? Any other ideas? Yes.
Yeah. I think there is one challenge in this whole discussion. We are thinking... Internet-based businesses talk completely separated from everything else. And I don't believe that you want to invest in Iceland only because of internet-related reasons. You have to have some additional reason, which is already there in Iceland. And that's why I think that the whole ecosystem aspect is so critical. All these aspects are important, but you have to have something in Iceland existing what is going to make investment reasonable. And as I said, small population means that there is no huge market for consumer-driven solutions. You have to have some better ideas. And I believe that small countries like Iceland have, as I said earlier, big potential to be first in applying information technology in sectors where services still are rather poor.
George?
Could I just add to what I don't come from the technology area, but listen to this debate. You can think of Iceland as sort of a very high-tech business center, innovative and so on, and therefore they're developing this industry in a sense. But then I would see, if you really want to change that, because that could be done somewhere else in the world too, would Iceland want to become... Like if you said, for example, we were talking about a Greek island, say we make it a green island, so everything is green, everything. I mean, your life becomes sort of into a sustainable type of energy. What if you thought of Iceland as a digitized society completely? So you go into the areas of health and education, as you mentioned, but daily life. How, therefore, do you make Iceland a model for a future digitized society? Rather than simply looking at it as a business center and interesting for innovation and so on. And therefore, you also put certain parameters. You could say a platform of values. I mean, certain values you would like to see as a society.
Yeah.
And that would then color your decisions on issues like patents and so on. Because you have, in patents and in medicines, for example, you have generic medicines. And there's a big debate about patents and medicines, whether you should, have cheap medicine for certain areas, where the governance comes in and says, listen, in this area... We want to do away with patents because this is our value. We want to help develop this area. There may be other areas where we don't really care, or we can just let the private sector, through legal methods, find out how to deal with it. So I would think this: why don't we think about what Iceland should be as a future prototype?
Right. Fantastic. So very visionary, the idea of the digital Iceland as a platform for digital development, and the question came up, and also for digital life. What other incentives could you offer people to live there? Singapore did something remarkable. They just actually paid startups to show up and funded them for half their salaries. So I'm getting a nod here, so I'm going to call on you, Derek, if that's all right.
A bit, but I think
tell us the story there. What
I don't actually know the full story, but I know the anecdote. I think that's what I wonder, to your points, what actually will attract new entrepreneurs
right.
into Iceland. Because a lot of these things are good, but they're quite in the weeds for what's actually going to move the needle in the economy. And so I think, you know, and the first question is, if you're having that meeting, what does a win look like for that prime minister?
Right.
And what do the campaign obstacles look like? And start to back out from there.
Yeah.
And I think, and that's, you know, that's one thing that I know you talked about. But yes, I mean, there are other sorts of incentives like that that you could think about.
Like real investment in startups and encouraging integration.
The money, you can give them space.
Yeah.
Right? You can give them a place where they can be and collaborate. And that's not, there's nothing legal about that, but the law can only take them so far.
So we're based in New York, and New York also had a financial collapse, and the government of New York came to us as a venture capital investor and said, we want to replace the financial services industry's tax roll with a new internet industry's tax roll. What do we need to do, and how do we do that? And we basically said, get out of the way. You know, and my experience with all of these incentives to attract investment or to create incubators and things has been pretty dismal. I think it's probably unrealistic to think that, and I don't even know whether Iceland has any interest in creating immigration into Iceland in order to increase the size of their economy. And I don't think we want to think about Iceland as a consumption economy, because there's 320,000 people, and that's not going to move anybody's needle. We need to think about it as an export economy. And if you think about it as an export economy, then the question is, how do you attract, for instance, a business? Let's pick a cloud-based security business that helps websites manage against all sorts of malware and denial of service attacks that might move its operations or some of its operations, employ a number of people in Iceland, but still be incorporated elsewhere, or have a subsidiary incorporated in Iceland if we have, you know, jurisdictional questions. Well, how do you do that? I think you can imagine attracting that with a policy framework without having to attract the people as well. I also think the idea that it should be a platform for innovation beyond sort of the narrow tech model that we're talking about is a good one. We had an earlier conversation about the possibility of, if you know, if Iceland was really innovative around the spectrum policy. You know, they have 2/3 of the population lives within 25 square miles in downtown Reykjavik. You could blanket that with more bandwidth than anybody anywhere has ever seen, and give everybody a device in their pocket that they already bought, that's already been engineered, you know, it's nothing special, that is connected to that fabric. And then all of a sudden you can begin thinking differently about lots of the way things work, you know, traffic lights or bus stops or pothole repairs, or, you know, all of a sudden you've got people embedded in a fabric that's different than anybody's ever seen. So you can begin to export that vision of a modern state that is beyond just tech policy. So that's, I think, the opportunity we're talking about.
That's fantastic. So a sandbox for innovation. Yes,
Just going along with that idea, and also Singapore, which you brought up, and I lived there for a few years. Singapore has a pretty small population, 3 million people, and they've built their economy on services and service provision and on banking. And one important aspect of this whole thing I'm by no means a banking expert, but banking regulations and transactional regulations, I think, would make a huge difference if Iceland could lower barriers to new kinds of digital transactions, and taking place not only within the first world, but within the 2/3 world, like India and China and the whole African continent, which are kind of excluded right now from international digital transactions, that would open up a massive market for Icelandic innovative services. So for startups based in Iceland who can interact with and generate new markets all over the world.
Mm-hmm. Could we dig into what kinds of transactions currently have high barriers? Digital transactions currently have barriers that can be fixed?
Mobile payments, for example. PayPal. So PayPal covers a lot of countries, but also doesn't cover a lot. We work with artists, musicians all over the world, and we've worked with musicians in Kenya and Haiti who would like to get their music online and would like to be able to sell on iTunes, and that's a whole other issue. But A lot of the platforms on which musicians sell require you to have a credit card, and an American or a European one, or, you know, a few Asian countries. So these are things where if, and I don't know how you would do it, I don't know how you would lower those barriers, but if you can innovate on ways in which to include these other markets and include these people who live in these countries who have expendable income but don't have a way to spend it with you, then I think you're opening up a lot of opportunity.
Oliver, use your hand.
Just to follow up on that, if there were a locus for legal, well-supported legal clearing for mobile device-style payment systems and that kind of thing, you know, they're cobbled together at the moment, but often without a jurisdictional anchor. The first world is often suspicious enough of unregulated transfer to put a lot of barrier in the way, both legal and business practice. But it could well be that actually providing a good center into which companies around the world could anchor their mobile payment practices would be an interesting goal.
I want to move into our next segment, in a sense, which is, okay, you've had your meeting with the minister, you've built the infrastructure, you've got all the legal policies, you've thought about ways to make Iceland both a digital society and to export values that you think are worthwhile and that will bring economic growth and social growth to Iceland. Now, how do you advise the minister to market this to the other 299,000 people in Iceland? This is a real problem. How do you say this is? We need to take these big steps right now. And here are my top arguments that you're going to present to the public. Be politicians. Yes.
So, I would say to put in the front the element of Iceland is also a reference in terms of political innovation, like a democratic laboratory. And this could be both useful in terms of presenting the proposal to the world, like Iceland as a reference of green economy or digital development, but also democratic innovation. And this could be also a way of convincing the Iceland people in the sense of this is not going to be against the process of democratization of the country with the crowdsourced constitution, but it's going to be in order to reinforce it, and it's going to be through learning of those processes.
Right. This is a society that elected people to write the constitution with feedback from the entire country. So maybe they're ready to be marketed to as a home laboratory of democratic innovation. What do you think will sing with the Icelandic heart? Yes.
Not to walk out too much, but I would say, you know, three things. I like speaking in threes. So one would be
the
externalities
session,
that get
yeah.
captured.
Yeah.
You know, as people build these next generation technologies, health IT, intelligent transportation, smart grids, whatever, the benefits of those are going to accrue to everyone else that happens to just be a guinea pig for that. But certainly that is a huge win. The network effects, unless Beckler's already left, but, you know, you're creating these commons where the network effects are going to be enormous as more and more people have access to smart vehicles, for example. That's hugely beneficial. And maybe the third would be, you know, the opportunity costs. I mean, Iceland doesn't have to do any of this, but then it really, really, really will be a backwater. And this is a, you know, a saving grace for an economy that really does need to figure out what's next.
Things are coming up in Iceland, you know, they're having a recovery and they're facing an election. They're doing a lot of civil service reworking, a lot of interesting things going on. But backwater lies ahead unless they take these steps. Other politicians here who want to talk about this? Yes, Kit.
I think Iceland is well positioned historically to present themselves as a country that has had great cultural production without very strong IP laws. And so they're in a position to say, this is what modern technology policy looks like in Iceland. And you may do it a different way somewhere else, but we've had great success in centuries of history democratically in a literary sense. With this system, and we'd like to try a modern experiment, and maybe the rest of the world can learn something from Iceland's leadership.
Iceland is a leader. Any other messages? Okay, so here we are at a really amazing opportunity of sort of a constitutional convention. Was that
I just wanted to ask a question.
Yeah.
We're just sort of making some assumptions about what the Icelandic sensibilities are.
I know.
Maybe one of the folks from Iceland would give it in a nutshell, sort of,
challenge. Encapsulate your country. Anybody? Ari, can you take a stab at that?
I would love for some of my colleagues to jump in, but...
If it comes to the question of convincing us that this is a good idea, I think you're on the right track. Icelanders like being noticed in the world. We're always the best per capita in just about everything we do. And we, for example, we have more people on Facebook per capita than any other country on the planet.
More per capitas on Facebook.
So yeah, so the highest proportion of the country is on Facebook. But it putting together the notion of actually Iceland having a role with the economic impact of it, and then pointing out the benefits to the individual, who then is, as somebody pointed out, you know, the benefits of the guinea pig, of being in that environment and being a leader in that. One of the things that I would like to point out, and it's following up on some of the things that you said earlier, is that Icelanders can also be skeptical.
Yeah.
So it's very easy in Iceland, it's a small community, to turn the conversation down the wrong track. Yeah. And one of the concerns that we have is that if we can frame this, is when we go selling it, how do we make sure that we don't look like we're doing something wrong? Mm. How do we make sure we don't look like we are going to be sheltering the criminals, you know, the bad material, all of this stuff that nobody wants to have around? Some of it is just blatantly, horribly illegal. Some of it is just blatantly stolen, etc. How do we make sure that we don't become something like that? And that would be one of the concerns that I would still have if I was hearing this proposition as it is. I don't think we have addressed that quite well enough.
Yeah.
So that's one of the characteristics of Icelanders, is that it's easy for them to jump onto something negative, and then if there isn't a solution for that, that will derail the whole process.
Well, you can't answer a problem with nothing. Yeah. So you've got to have something to suggest to counter the skepticism even before it comes up. So what are the lists of suggestions? Yes, Brad.
So One thought that that would address this issue of not positioning Iceland as a haven, haven for child pornography or terrorism or any of the bad things that we think of as being possible in a data haven, would be to, as an example, this radical thought, but only allow certain things that are stored in Iceland to be encrypted. So you could make the distinction based on the number of people who you allow access to. So obviously if I have corporate records or contracts or transactions that have specific names all through them and I wasn't able to encrypt those, then the data itself, the content itself, is very revealing about my intentions and who I'm working with, and that would be hard. But the likelihood that I want to show that to a million people is also very low. So you could actually come up with a combination which says, you know, for any piece of data that's being shown to a million people, if it's encrypted, it's either pornography or a hot movie. But if it's only being shown to a small number of people, it can remain encrypted. If it's being shown to a lot of people, it has to be unencrypted. And then you can use automated systems to take down the bad stuff.
Responses. Yeah, you
can. Yeah, a couple of comments. First, I think it's a very important aspect that don't try to compromise. You have to be able to, if you want to have a profile for a nation, you have to be very, keep it simple.
Yeah.
And I think this aspect that Iceland is already now, in spite of all these banking sector crisis factors, Iceland is known as a reliable nation where everything works. And to be honest, there are few exceptions in the world, countries where that type of let's say, illustrations are facts. And I think that is a good basis for innovation. Mm-hmm. So if you have a society which works, that is a good basis. And I think still Iceland is number one reading nation in the world. Yeah, you are not only internet nation, but you are reading nation as well.
That's right.
Sometimes they are the same, sometimes not. And finally, keep it simple. I as I said about this identification of comparative advantages worldwide, you have to be simple. But also internally, you have to be very simple. You have to be able to explain to the people that we are not doing something which is going to change the country completely. We have, and you have a lot of assets in Iceland, good assets which are still extremely valuable in the global market, but you have to create for the future new assets, and this is about that. And finally, quite often politicians are so short-sighted. And we are learning people also to expect that something happens overnight. Mm-hmm. And I think if you want to do something like this, the time horizon is not next year or next 5 years, but 10, 15 years. And then you can see something real to happen. And that is, I know from personal experience, that is very difficult for politicians to do that type of things because they are out when reward is coming.
Before we get into it, yes.
Elaborate on the Finnish experience after the collapse of the Soviet Union. How you, because this is more or less the way you went, except it was in technology rather than cyberspace, so to speak. Can you elaborate a little bit on that? What you did to educational policies, law and regulation, and support to innovation and things like that?
I think very important factor in the case of Finland was a decision made 10 years before the collapse, or even more than 10 years before the collapse of the Soviet Union. Finland decided that we will double our R&D expenditure in 10 years. We are below the OECD average on the 1% level 1980. We decided to double that, and that happened. Year 1990, we were on the level of 2%. But if we asked or made a research, was it reasonable investment made? And you made that analysis 1990. The outcome had been not reasonable. We have not seen any results. But if you asked the same question 5 years later, all had said that was the best investment Finland had ever made. Because we were able to start utilizing that when information technology revolution and especially mobile technology revolution started. That is a good example of what I mean about time horizon. And politics is, unfortunately, its timing is election period, and it is too short for these type of investments. And that's why I think that politicians should be able to communicate things in a different way. We see that in Europe as well. I was listening yesterday what Commission's president had been speaking. He was speaking about too much about short-term objectives, what to do now and tomorrow. I think Europe can survive and get out of this crisis only when doing long-term investment for the future. And that is the most critical thing. I think Finland succeeded in that. We were very lucky. Without luck, we had not been coming out of that.
Okay, so investing in the building blocks of innovation over a long-term horizon. And speaking of building blocks, we're about to come to a close here, but we're at Berkman, with Berkman, speaking to this distinguished group. How can we best continue the engagement? I'd like some suggestions along that line. We've met each other, we'll hang around, maybe exchange some cards. What should happen next in the view of either part of this? Yes, Nick.
One specific thing that is already happening and can continue to happen is that we have a mailing list of folks who are part of this delegation, but also other folks around the country who are interested in these issues. So I'd encourage any of you to join that.
And who's the we in that?
We is...
we have a mailing list.
Oh, sorry. Where's Charter Node. Sorry, charternode@googlegroups.com. And I guess I don't know the best way to get everybody here to join that if they want, but charternode@googlegroups.com or email me at nickgrossman@gmail.com. And we also are capturing this wiki, which will persist. But the email list would be a great way for everybody to stay involved if they want to continue this conversation. A lot of smart people on that from around the world.
Okay, fantastic. Any other ideas? Yes.
In a second, just on the political side, to sell this whole infrastructure, we were
talking about, I think a really important point to emphasize is the point of strengthening civil society and giving power to civil society. I think as far as I understand it, the trauma of Iceland in the aftermath of the financial crisis was that the people of Iceland had quite a great deal of confidence in its economic system and in its economic growth. And at the end of the day, the banks had this huge impact on the economy. And when it collapsed, the people realized that the banks had made bad bets and that they weren't informed about what was happening, right? So I think both on the political side, stress the fact that you want to strengthen civil society through the net, through connectivity, empower the people to engage the government, engage in policy, control what's actually happening democratically speaking. This goes back to Mayo's point, is a good way to sell this, and also sell this networked society and powerful civil society to rebalance the economic model towards user innovation, as Mako said, startups who can like use public information that's really available online and released to build and try up new things. And as far as the property rights, and this is for the lawyers, are properly enforced within society, there is no contradiction between user innovation and a profitable business. And those two can actually go side by side. And this is a totally new area, but we have like communities that in the area of video games, for instance, that collaborate with profitable firms to produce. And this is a totally new economic model. We don't know what's gonna happen with it, but I think it's a good venue to start.
Thank you so much. So from each lunch in our lives, this wave of impressions we take away, the key thing I want you to remember about this is just interest and excitement and opportunity that here's a country that has the capacity, potentially, to think through all these issues carefully and to make its stand on the world stage as a leader. So we're delighted that we got the chance to talk to you, and so let's all give ourselves a round of applause. And
thanks, Susan, for facilitating. That was really great. And there's a piece of paper circulating around. If you want to stay in touch, put your email on. We can invite you that way. It'll be easier. So thanks again. This has been wonderful.